I have testimonies from people there who reported to me that amid the starvation of the Gaza Strip and the Gaza City in particular, the Israeli army at checkpoints, when they cross the checkpoints, the Israeli army and Israeli soldiers tell the residents that if you want to eat, go to the south. So this is like a kind of intimidation and forced displacement tool for Palestinians, that if they want to really live, they have to evacuate, to forcibly evacuate their homes and comply with the Israeli orders to go to the southern parts of the Gaza Strip. And this is why I think that Israel is allowing aid into the southern Gaza Strip. It's not only for the mere benefit of the residents, because they have been bombing also residents who are allowed to get some food here in the southern Gaza Strip. But I think that this is kind of
Maha Hosseini, we have to end it there.
For civilians to,
but
to,
I thank you so much for being with us, and thank you for your courage. Maha Hosseini, award-winning independent journalist and activist based in Gaza, reporting to us from there.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for this program comes from KBOO members in Portland Public Schools preschool programs, offering education and support for families of preschoolers. Enrolling now for children who will be 3 to 4 by September 1st. Information at pps.net/early learners.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, by the end of the summer, Portland police will all wear body cameras after years of debate. The Long Bend Fire in Wasco County has burned 1,000 acres since Saturday. And in national news, a new report details how big oil companies have neglected their promises to invest in clean energy. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, June 24th, 2024. I'm Althea Billings. Portland police across the bureau will begin wearing body cameras in the next month or two. It's a long-awaited program that followed nearly a decade of fierce negotiations. The Central Precinct were issued their body cameras today, according to Portland police. Last summer, there was a few months-long pilot project to test out the cameras. Body-worn cameras will be used by North Precinct officers starting in mid-July. East Precinct police are expected to start in mid-August. PPB says they need to upgrade the internet connection there before they can give out the cameras. With these cameras, Portland police will no longer be the largest municipal police agency in the U.S. without body-worn cameras. In those negotiations that took nearly a decade, the biggest sticking point between the city and its police union was whether to allow officers who use deadly force to view camera footage before writing their reports or being interviewed by investigators. Under a negotiated policy, officers who use deadly force will not be able to view their camera's footage until they provide an audio-recorded statement within 48 hours of the incident. A video shared by the police bureau shows officers removing the cameras about the size and shape of a deck of cards from a charging wall and then clipping the device onto their vest at around chest height. The cameras will automatically begin recording when officers either draw their weapons or activate their vehicle's flashing lights, thanks to Bluetooth sensors. When those sensors activate, they'll also turn on the cameras of any other officer within 100 feet. U.S. District Judge Michael H. Simon recommended that the city equip officers with body cameras for accountability nearly 10 years ago. There are still ongoing talks about this between the city and the Justice Department, which oversees a settlement agreement on Portland police conduct towards people experiencing mental distress. It has to do with when and where those recordings will be available. The feds want immediate access to the footage through a website called evidence.com, and they want a court-appointed independent monitoring team to have direct access to the footage too. What is decided, though, is that body camera recordings will be stored on a cloud system where they cannot be deleted or edited. They can be accessed by filing a public records request. The Long Bend Fire has burned 1,000 acres since Saturday. It's located 2 miles southwest of Maupin in Wasco County on the west side of the Deschutes River. There is a level 2 get ready evacuation notice for all residences south of Highway 216 between Natural Pasture Road and Blue Rock Road. It also goes for all residences east of Reservation Road. Boaters are also advised to be cautious in the area because helicopters are dipping into the water to help fight the fire. Central Oregon Fire Information wrote on their website, quote, "Most of the fire's growth yesterday occurred in the Wapanita Canyon area. Firefighters engaged on the western edge of the fire in places that were safe to access, while dozers conducted operations in the flat terrain above the canyon. The southern and eastern portions of the fire remained quiet. Engines continued to patrol the eastern line to ensure that spot fires do not occur on the east side of the Deschutes River," end quote. More information and maps of the fire can be found online at centraloregonfire.org. Washington State has joined the AARP Network of Age-Friendly States and Communities and USA Aging Dementia-Friendly America Network. These underscore the work that Washington has been doing to improve the lives of older Washingtonians. Eric Tegedoff has more on the state's efforts.
Washington has received designations that highlight the state's efforts to become more age and dementia friendly. Washington is the 12th state to join the AARP Network of Age-Friendly States and Communities. Susan Ingalls, Office Chief for the Unit on Aging for the Washington State Department of Social and Health Services, says the designation builds on work the state is already doing to support people of all ages.
Age-friendly communities consider goals that promote high quality of life for each person, regardless of their age, allowing older people the opportunity to remain active in their community. So the designation begins a book of work that we're very excited to do.
Some cities in the state have already joined the AARP Age-Friendly Network, such as Puyallup, Renton, Seattle, Tacoma, and White Salmon. Some of the goals for age-friendly communities include ensuring people can age in place and building walkable communities to ensure people can maintain both their independence and connection with others. Washington is also joining U.S. Aging's Dementia-Friendly America Network. Ingalls says the state is already supporting people with dementia.
Developing more community opportunities for families living with dementia, things like zoo walks and cafes where people can come and not worry about being judged if their loved one behaves differently.
Family caregiving is another important area as the population ages. According to AARP statistics, the number of family caregivers available in Washington will decline from about 4.5 in 2030 to less than 3 in 2050. But Ingalls says the state has support in these areas as well, such as through respite and counseling to help people maintain these roles.
We have innovative programs, both state-funded and federally funded, where we are able to support family caregivers, regardless of income levels, with services that help those family caregivers be able to maintain their role.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Next week, Portland's minimum wage will bump up 50 cents, reaching $15.95 starting July 1st. Across the state, the minimum wage will also increase. In urban counties outside the Portland area, it'll reach $14.70, and in rural counties, the minimum wage will be $13.70. The minimum wage in Oregon has been on a tiered system since 2017. Since 2023, the annual increase in the minimum wage has been tied to the rate of inflation. That's around a 3% hike for these different wage tiers. According to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Living Wage Calculator, a single adult in Oregon with no children needs to make $24.30 an hour to meet all their basic needs. That's nearly $10 more than the new minimum wage in Portland. For comparison, the federal minimum wage has been stuck at $7.25 an hour since 2009. School's out for the summer, but a lack of learning opportunities can leave kids behind when they head back to school next year. The organization Save the Children is offering advice on how parents and caregivers can include learning into everyday activities. It's also providing events to help kids in rural areas. Amy Barlay is the Washington State Program Specialist for Save the Children. She says parents are kids' first and most important teachers, and they can help children learn in many different situations.
Cooking, and this is good for all ages, getting kids in the kitchen. When you're doubling a recipe, it's a really important way of talking about fractions, adding fractions, or using measuring cups.
Barlay says for younger kids, parents can pick a letter and ask kids to find things that start with that letter. She says families can also look into their family history and notes that parents and caregivers can make books more fun by drawing characters from them or acting them out. Barlay says Washington is one state where Save the Children is holding Make Summer Fair events, which is giving kids in rural areas learning opportunities.
There's many wonderful things about growing up in a rural community. There's lots to offer. But one thing that we know is that rural communities are often under-resourced when it comes to providing structured learning activities over the summer, leaving kids kind of at a loss.
Yolanda Miner is an early learning specialist with Save the Kids, and she has advice for parents who are looking to incorporate learning into the summer.
Let them know to make it fun for children. We want children to foster a love for reading and not think that these engagements are chores or anything.
Former President Trump appeals to conservatives who want a national abortion ban. New data shows President Biden fares well with older voters, and Drag Lobby Day brings the Queens to Capitol Hill to press for LGBTQ plus protections. With more on these stories, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks. We're following our democracy in historic times.
If the radical Democrat extremes get their way, they will have a federal law for abortion.
Over the weekend, former President Donald Trump spoke to evangelicals and citing efforts in Congress to make Roe the law of the land. He again took credit for appointing three Supreme Court justices who helped overturn it. The Faith and Freedom Coalition has been fighting for a national abortion ban, but Trump says the decision should be left to the states. At the same event, Trump repeated that he has made his VP pick. Meanwhile, Vice President Kamala Harris says most Americans will continue to vote to protect their reproductive freedoms. She calls that access part of a healthcare crisis for many who look to the clinics for more than just abortions.
In those clinics that are trusted in the community, you can get a PAP, breast cancer screening, HIV screening.
About 6 in 10 Americans say abortion should be legal in all or most cases, according to the Pew Research Center. Former federal prosecutor and University of Alabama law professor Joyce Vance says she's confident the justice system can handle a defendant like Trump, but adds she has more confidence in American voters.
You know, the biggest check on Donald Trump has been us, the voters. And I continue to believe that that's the biggest check on Donald Trump. It's really hard to contest an election when the numbers are overwhelming.
President Joe Biden's reelection team is looking to expand its appeal to older voters in key states. His campaign is rolling out its Seniors for Biden-Harris effort, led by First Lady Jill Biden.
Age is a gift. I mean, but there are still those who not only devalue our wisdom and dismiss our experience, they want to destroy the structures that help us thrive.
New data shows older voters are supporting Biden, even putting him a full 15 points ahead of Trump in a new Fox News poll. Three drag queens will be on Capitol Hill tomorrow for Drag Lobby Day, calling for greater protections for LGBTQ people. Austin, Texas-based drag queen Bridget Bandit will be one of those advocating for the Equality Act to to extend federal non-discrimination protections to LGBTQ people and the Transgender Bill of Rights.
And we have the responsibility to combat the increasingly hateful attacks on our LGBTQIA+ community. In the words of my favorite drag queen, Sasha Velour, violence is never the answer, but drag might be.
2 decades after the first state in the U.S. permitted same-sex couples to marry, a new report finds that marriage equality has made a profound impact on their lives. Clark University professor of psychology, Abby Goldberg, calls marriage equality successful public health.
They have access to health insurance. They are physically and mentally healthier. They're able to share the challenges and work of raising children.
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Big Oil is dropping the ball when it comes to meeting their public pledges to help avert catastrophic climate change. That's according to a new Oil Change International analysis of the 8 biggest U.S. and European producers. U.S.-based corporations Chevron, ConocoPhillips, and ExxonMobil each ranked grossly insufficient on all of the report's criteria. Co-author David Tong says just 5% of the sector's capital investments are in clean energy. Over 90% is going into fossil fuels.
None of them come anywhere close with aligning with what's needed to confront the climate crisis. Instead of cutting production, they almost all aim to increase production this critical decade.
Several oil companies mentioned in the report are said to have misrepresented their climate plans. The oil and gas industry has argued that finding new places to drill is necessary to meet demand during a transition to clean energy, especially in hard-to-electrify industries like concrete production and air travel. Leading global scientists say fossil fuel pollution must peak before 2025, then fall by 43% by 2030, and reach net zero by 2050 to prevent the worst impacts of a changing climate. Tong says there is no pathway to meet those climate targets that includes expanding oil and gas production.
If companies stopped approving new fields, what would be left in their existing producing fields would be enough to meet the world's energy demand.
Because oil and gas corporations are not likely to voluntarily transition their business model, Tong believes governments will need to intervene. The marketplace could also play a role. Tong points to new global data showing that for the first time, $2 are being invested in clean energy for every dollar invested in fossil fuels.
The transition's underway. Governments need to resist the pressure of the industry that has done the most to cause the climate crisis and accelerate the change. It's happening. It's just not happening fast enough.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, LTAR, Let's Talk About Race. Tonight's weather will be clear with an overnight low of 51 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be warm and sunny with a high of 86. Today in history, in 2022, the U.S. Supreme Court hands down its decision in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization, overturning the right to an abortion established in the decision Roe v. Wade. It instead leaves regulation of the procedure up to the individual states. The quote of the day is from American historian Alfred Whitney Griswold, who wrote, quote, "Books won't stay banned, they won't burn, ideas won't go to jail. In the long run of history, the censor and the inquisitor have always lost. The only sure weapon against bad ideas is better ideas." A sacred red rock has been returned to the Kaw Nation after being taken from the tribe and put on display in Kansas. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A sacred red rock to the Kaw Nation that was taken from the tribe and put on display in Lawrence, Kansas, has returned to its original homelands in Council Grove, Kansas. Rhonda Lavaldo has a story on the celebration that was held over the weekend.
A rematriation held Saturday for Injuje Wahobe, which in the Kaw language translates to Sacred Red Rock, was done at its new home on Kaw land in Alagawaho Memorial Heritage Park near Council Grove. Kaw tribal citizen Storm Brave spoke on the event.
I just hope and pray from this day on that it is respected amongst this community, since we aren't able to take it back to Washunga, Oklahoma, where we are now. It's a good way to remind people that our Gonze people are still here and we're still thriving and growing. I hope that our Injuje Wahobe is kind of a steward into our future.
Vice Chair of the Kaw Nation, Jim Pepper Henry, also spoke of the support of the local community.
The Kaw Nation is humbled by the outpouring of support for this project, and we respectfully ask our neighbors to assist us in the stewardship and care of Alagawaho Memorial Heritage Park.
The park was part of the last reservation the Kaw people had in Kansas before they were removed to Oklahoma. The Kaw Nation bought the land back in 2002. Injuje Wahobe, the sacred red rock, was deposited at the intersection of the Shunga-Nunga Creek and the Kansas River near Tecumseh by glaciers during the last ice age. It remained there until 95 years ago when it was moved to Lawrence. This is Rhonda Lavaldo for National Native News.
A new mobile clinic is now serving about 2,000 tribal patients in rural Nevada. It's one of the largest beneficiaries in the region of a federal grant program. KUNR's Maria Palma reports for the Mountain West News Bureau.
The unit will provide services to both the Lovelock Paiute tribe and the Yomba Shoshone tribe. Without a mobile clinic, medical staff would make weekly trips in multiple vehicles covering hundreds of miles to provide medical services. Kathy Williams-Tooney, chairwoman of the Fallon Paiute Shoshone tribe, says it's a dream come true.
We have the remote two locations at Yomba and Lovelock, and sometimes to go out to Lovelock, they always have to take the 4x4s because of the roads. Much of the road is dirt.
Clinical nurse Joy Schultz says the mobile clinic will bring people immunizations, lab testing, physician and nurse visits, wound care, prescription medicine distribution, and education.
We can say we've actually saved lives, we've saved limbs, we've saved communities from COVID.
The new mobile clinic was funded through a $670,000 emergency rural healthcare grant provided by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. I'm Maria Palma.
The FBI is seeking information from the public about the cause of the South Fork and Salt Fires in New Mexico, burning on the Mescalero Apache Reservation and near Rio Doso. A flyer released by the FBI says it's offering $10,000 for information leading to, quote, the arrest and conviction of the person or persons responsible for starting the fires. The FBI's Albuquerque field office is assisting tribal, local, state, and federal partners in the investigation of the fires, which were discovered last week. The FBI has a telephone tip line, an online tip form, or is taking information in person at local FBI offices. The fires combined have burned more than 24,000 acres. As of Saturday, the South Fork fire was 26% contained, and the Salt Fire was 7% contained. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Debt collection on defaulted loans for student loan borrowers around the country will resume in September. Advocates are calling on the Department of Education to expand outreach efforts to help reach and engage with borrowers. Alex Gonzalez has more in Nevada.
Policy analysts are concerned that the Department of Education isn't reaching and engaging with low-income and disadvantaged student loan borrowers in the most effective ways. Tia Caldwell with New America is one of the authors of a new report that highlights more than 40% of low-income borrowers aren't aware of income-driven repayment plans. She says that's concerning because debt collection on defaulted loans will resume in September. While the Biden administration has helped struggling borrowers through its Saving on a Valuable Education plan, Caldwell says some still don't know about its benefits. In Nevada, more than 36,000 federal student loan borrowers have enrolled. Caldwell says the department should consider new outreach methods.
The Department of Ed is just missing a whole chunk of people. And so we really heard from a variety of outreach experts that you need to reach people through multiple mediums. So we'd love to see more texting and creative ideas like push notifications, things like that, reaching borrowers where they actually are on their phones.
Caldwell says that unless the department and its contractors' outreach improves, borrowers from marginalized backgrounds will be at a high risk of default when debt collections resume. She recognizes that while the department and its contractors have made improvements, they can continue to make strides, but that'll take more funding and prioritization from Congress. Caldwell says the report lays out a number of recommendations that can help improve communication, which should first come from the Department of Education. But it also touches on the role other government agencies could play as trusted messengers when they come into contact with student loan borrowers.
We'd love to see like an all of government approach so that if a vulnerable borrower or low income person reaches the government in any way, they'll be screened for a variety of different needs and directed to a variety of different benefits that they need. So SNAP, student loan assistance, all of that through any door. That's like a pie in the sky thing. It's far away.
Caldwell adds there is also a significant need for what she calls user testing, meaning the Department of Education understands what it's like to be a borrower, navigating what at times can be complex systems, and subsequently talks with them about what's working and what's not. For Nevada News Service, I'm Alex Gonzalez.
It's getting to the end of June, the time of year when the U.S. Supreme Court issues its opinions on important cases. So far, there have been two decisions related to guns, and domestic violence organizations say one issued on Friday will hopefully ensure that many survivors will be protected, along with other populations. Mike Moen reports from Minnesota.
Domestic violence organizations in Minnesota continue to express relief over a U.S. Supreme Court ruling that dealt with abusers having access to firearms. In an 8-1 decision released Friday, the court upheld a federal law barring people subject to a domestic violence restraining order from owning guns. Violence Free Minnesota says from 1989 to 2018, guns were used in nearly half of cases around the state where adult women were killed by an intimate partner. Connie Moore oversees Alexandra House, a service organization for survivors in the Twin Cities. She notes these weapons also are used to intimidate a partner who is planning to escape a dangerous situation.
Many victim survivors have reported about a gun being pointed at them and threatening, "I'll kill you if you leave me."
Moore says there are still challenges in ensuring a gun's removal, even when a restraining order has been issued. Minnesota does have a law that covers the removal process, but support groups say there's uneven enforcement around the country. This decision comes 2 years after the Supreme Court greatly expanded gun rights. Moore says the federal law not only protects survivors and their children, but also first responders and 911 calls stemming from domestic violence.
We know that domestic calls for law enforcement are one of the most dangerous calls that they go on.
She points to the three first responders killed earlier this year in a call in the suburb of Burnsville. That tragedy led to a change in state law concerning straw purchases of guns. Meanwhile, survivor groups also press for reforms when it comes to obtaining a protection order, noting there are a range of barriers just getting that step taken care of. This is Mike Moen for Minnesota News Connection.
It's been 2 decades since the first state in the U.S. permitted same-sex couples to marry. A new report finds that marriage equality has had a profound positive impact on their lives. Still, a majority of couples nationwide say they're concerned that Obergefell v. Hodges, the Supreme Court ruling that legalized same-sex marriage, could be overturned. For more, we go to Catherine Carley in New Hampshire.
20 years after the first state permitted marriage equality, a majority of same-sex married couples say it had a profound positive impact on their lives. A new report finds it strengthened couples' relationships, provided legal protections, financial security, and a greater acceptance among family and friends. Clark University Professor of Psychology Dr. Abby Goldberg says marriage equality is part of a public health agenda.
They have access to health insurance. They are physically and mentally healthier. They're able to share the challenges and work of raising children.
Still, Goldberg says nearly 80% of couples surveyed worry about the future of marriage equality. Supreme Court Justices Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas have both suggested the High Court revisit Obergefell v. Hodges, the decision which legalized same-sex marriage in 2015. The report reveals same-sex married couples are also concerned about what they call an increasingly hostile environment in the U.S. More than 500 anti-LGBTQ+ bills have been introduced since last year, including in New Hampshire, where lawmakers have advanced measures targeting transgender youth. Goldberg says concerns are forcing couples to consider relocating to more accepting states or even outside the U.S.
It's creating not just legal uncertainty, but propelling them to think about the future in ways that require time, money, planning.
Goldberg says marriage equality created families, and the report reveals the positives to ensuring people are protected. Almost 60% of participants said marriage provided more stability or security for their children, and often created new in-laws who could help. For New Hampshire News Connection, I'm Catherine Carley.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, June 24th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Alex Gonzalez, Mike Moen, Catherine Carley, and Antonia Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members, lovely folks like you. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Making Contact.
Clausens are a middle-class family in a small college town, Bloomington, Indiana. Their neighborhood streets wind through